This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Super Bowl Sunday. Besides the football and the halftime show, there's the food, the pizza, the chips and dip, and for many, the beer. We all know it's not the healthiest way to eat, and we could probably just as easily put veggies and hummus on the table. So why do we keep going for the fatty, salty stuff? What makes it all so good anyway? Joining me now to explain what's going on in our brains when we make these kinds of food choices is Rachel Herz. She's a neuroscientist who studies smell, and she's written a book called Why You Eat What You Eat. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather. It's great to be on.
If you look up a Super Bowl game day menu, I mean, there are things that come up every single time, right? And it's wings, it's pizza, it's burgers, it's chips and dip, it's nachos, like salty, fatty carbs is kind of the theme there with all of those things. What's going on there?
Well, I think there's a couple of simple explanations. One of them actually just has to do with tradition. It's kind of like, why is pumpkin pie associated with Thanksgiving? It's because it just started becoming a dessert that everybody brought. And potentially, unfortunately, things like nachos and chicken wings and loaded potato skins and things like that have become the traditional foods of Super Bowl parties. But the additional part of it is that it seems like a celebration, and it's part of what sort of gets people into the mood of the game. So eating those foods, because they also make us feel good, is part of what actually keeps us going when we're in the mode of watching the Super Bowl.
I mean, we all know it's a guilty pleasure, right? So what actually makes it feel good to eat those foods?
Well, you know, special occasions are when people feel like they can give themselves a license to ill, as it were, when it comes to eating. And so we give ourselves passes on things like Thanksgiving, on New Year's Eve, and the Super Bowl. You know, the Super Bowl is actually the second biggest eating day of the year after Thanksgiving.
Wow.
So there's kind of an acknowledged, you know, we're going to be bad today and it's okay, but we don't do this every day.
There's also the effect of the smells, the sounds, the lighting that's around you when you're making food choices. You think about a Super Bowl party, probably lots of people, loud, there's a TV going. How does all of that affect the kinds of food choices that we make?
Definitely with respect to the stimulation around us, one of the biggest factors with respect to food consumption is actually social stimulation. The more people we eat with, the more we eat. And there again, there's some sort of straightforward explanations. One, with more people over, you're going to have made more food and they're going to have brought food. So there's a lot more food around when you have 25 people over than if you only have three. Plus, the food is sort of sitting around. It's in front of the TV. It's on the table nearby. And the longer you're in front of food, the more likely you are to eat food. In addition, you have this amazing distraction of the Super Bowl game itself, as well as the commercials and the conversation. So you're not paying very much attention to what you're eating. And this is another big slip when it comes to food consumption. When we're distracted, we tend to eat a lot more. And television is a major culprit for that.
You already mentioned the idea that, you know, we kind of give ourselves a pass because this is one day, one event. It's not how we're going to eat every day. But what about the day after? I mean, do we all go on kind of a repentant diet?
So the Monday after a Super Bowl, the way we eat actually has a lot to do with whether or not our home team has won or lost, and also how dedicated we are as fans. So, for example, for New England fans, on Monday, if by, you know, rare possible chance the Patriots lose, it's more likely that people will binge actually on high fat foods on that Monday. So people feeling that loss of their home team are going to be eating more pizza, eating more nachos, kind of drowning their sorrows in comfort foods. Whereas if your home team wins, then on that following Monday, you're actually less likely to eat comfort food that day and, in fact, may follow a somewhat healthier diet. So you'll be eating, you know, a green salad, hold the dressing, but it doesn't have to do necessarily with repentance from the day before. Because if your home team loses, then your big munch out on Monday is not compensated for on Tuesday. So if you're drowning your sorrows in pizza and chips on Monday, on Tuesday, you're not going to have salads instead. You're just going to eat regularly.
Rachel Herz, you're a neuroscientist who studies smell. And I have to wonder, with all of these different factors that we're talking about, I mean, we tend to think we make food choices because something smells good, it tastes good, right? That's why we want to eat it. How much actually do those senses have to do with determining what we decide to pick up and put in our mouths?
Well, certainly the sense of smell is a tremendous lure when it comes to food, as well as it is what actually gives food flavor. So taste is really just salty, sour, sweet, and bitter. And everything else that you experience from eating is due to your nose, is due to the aromas from your mouth getting up from your mouth into your nose and synergizing with the taste of the food itself and creating the flavor. So that is to say, the taste of bacon is just salt. It's the aromas coming from that strip of bacon as you're chewing it that get up into your nostrils that then bind with the taste of salt and make it that amazing sensation. So first of all, that's the experience of eating. And then secondly, of course, we can be completely led by our nostrils when something smells really good. And this can override feelings of hunger. So, you know, it's kind of dangerous to be around food that's cooking when you're, you know, you're maybe a little bit hungry, but you don't necessarily have to eat and something smells really good, you're going to dive in. However, if you're stuffed, then the smell of that same favorite food can actually become unpleasant because it's like, if I have to see another chicken wing or I have to smell another chicken wing, I'm going to be sick. So it all depends on your internal state.
I was fascinated to read in your book, Why You Eat What You Eat, that the whole idea of a map of taste buds around our tongue, that we taste different things with different parts of our tongue, that's actually a false idea. But the story of how it came about is kind of fascinating. Where did that idea even come from?
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting little social science history where what happened was in the early 1940s, Edwin Boring, who is a professor at Harvard University, read a paper that was written by a German graduate student in German, and he misinterpreted the results as saying that the tip of the tongue is where you taste sweet, the sides of the tongue are for salty and sour, and the back of the tongue is for bitter. And he published his interpretation, his in English, in a very popular, very famous textbook in the early mid-1940s, and it soon became repeated and repeated and very easily could be visually illustrated like a map. And so the tongue map was born and just got repeated and so on and so forth. And then in the early mid-1970s, Virginia Collings, who is a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh, decided to go back to that original experiment and do her own taste testing. And she actually found what in fact was what the original student had found, which is that there are tiny differences in certain specific places, but basically we can taste every taste sensation everywhere. She published her results, but nothing really happened in terms of, you know, the popular zeitgeist. And, you know, when there's a simple explanation and it can be easily illustrated and it's been repeated, it's really hard to get that out of our collective consciousness and to get the more kind of murky, complicated, not very sexy drawing or no drawing at all, you know, to be the reality.
Well, I mean, when you said we can taste everything everywhere, you were referring to the tongue. But then you also write that we, in fact, have taste receptors in all sorts of places all over and all inside our bodies. I mean, where else are these taste receptors and why?
So we have taste receptors in our stomach, in our pancreas, in our lungs, in our intestines. If you're a man, you have taste receptors in your testicles.
Okay, and that's just, I mean, the ones in your digestive tract, you might be able to.
Yeah. So, well, the way you need to think about this, so only the taste receptors that are in our tongue are hooked up to our brain in terms of the taste cortex. So we can only taste, you know, something sweet with our tongue. We can't taste something as being sweet with our lungs or elsewhere. Now, the reason why we have these taste receptors in different parts of our bodies is because taste receptors are really chemical detection systems. And we detect chemicals throughout our body. And actually, from the point of view of testicles, if you're a man, so sperm have to find an egg. And the way that they swim towards the egg is actually by sensing chemical signals coming from the egg to direct it towards it. Now, interestingly, though, the taste receptors that are in our lungs are, in fact, responding sort of more directly, possibly, to things we're ingesting. So if you breathe in something noxious, you cough. So the receptors that are responding to those chemicals in your lungs are trying to expel them out of your body. And actually, the taste receptors in our intestines, where we're doing food digestion, are responding to chemicals that are in foods and also letting us know, is this something that made us feel good to eat? Or was this something that, made us feel kind of sick to eat? So there's an interaction between food and the taste receptors in our stomach, but it's more indirect and a little more complicated than the obvious ones that happen in our mouth.
I'm talking with Rachel Herz. She's a neuroscientist and author of Why You Eat What You Eat. I mean, you're talking about, the taste receptors in your intestine, whether you feel good or bad, the physical, physiological level, whether something is making you nauseous or not. But we were talking before about foods making us feel good on an emotional level. And we have this phrase, emotional eaters. Aren't we all emotional eaters?
Yes, to a certain extent, I think we're all emotional eaters, although there are a small set of people who claim that their only reason and need for food is for fuel. This was probably why Soylent was ever invented in the first place, though not very successfully, because there's no pleasure from it. So we, generally speaking, love to consume foods that are high in sugar, high in fat, high in carbohydrates, so they could also be salty. And these are foods that make us feel good neurobiologically. So our brain actually responds like something really fantastic is happening when we taste sweet, when we taste fat. And it actually both turns on the pleasure and reward centers of our brain and reduces pain, both physically and emotionally. So if you're kind of in an emotional pain state, eating things that are high sugar and high fat actually, momentarily at least, make us feel better. Now, the problem is the momentarily component of it, because oftentimes afterwards, we then feel even worse emotionally because oh my God, I just ate a whole tub of ice cream. Now I feel even more awful, even though at the time it did feel good to consume it. So one of the things I like to sort of counsel people, very loosely stated, is to ask yourself the question while you're consuming something, whether or not you're in a state of emotional distress or just loving what you're eating, is the experience of pleasure worth the calories or whatever is going to be the end result of eating this? So the first scoop of or bite or spoonful of ice cream or cake or cookies or chocolate or french fries, yes, that tastes delicious. I want more. But what about after the fifth bite or the 10th bite? And so if you are at least present enough in your mind to be able to assess, this is no longer giving me what I started eating this for, then that's the time to stop. The problem is most people don't start thinking that question until they're way beyond, the time that they really should have stopped from the point of view of pleasure.
There are tricks that can trick us into eating more. Maybe I shouldn't call them tricks, right? But we've talked about some of these emotional or environmental factors, like more people being around, right? Or just being distracted. Are there ways we can use some of that to maybe trick ourselves into eating more healthfully?
Yes. I mean, the biggest tip really is to just pay attention, because the more engaged you are with eating, the more satisfaction you get from it and the more satiation you get from it. So you'll need less to feel full. But if you want some, additional tricks and tips, one of the things that I think is really interesting, size of plate and portion size is a major issue these days. I mean, the size of plates that we have in our cupboard for regular eating were the size of serving plates 50 or 60 years ago, where the whole platter of food was being served. And so we have this idea that the amount of food on the plate is the amount that we're supposed to eat. And we also don't like it when we put only what looks like a small amount of food on a big plate, because it looks like we're getting ripped off and, oh my God, I hardly ate anything. So the idea is to use smaller plates, but maybe not like super small plates, so oh my God, I'm just giving myself a tiny plate, and to fill that plate. And one really great way of doing that potentially is to use concave bowls, so that the top of the circle of the bowl looks like it's reasonably wide, but then it narrows down quite considerably so that you don't actually get to fill it with that much food, but it looks like we have enough food and therefore we'll be satisfied with it. Another really interesting trick is to use red plates. Now, this is also a good tip for the Super Bowl party. So if you're hosting and you want to help your guests not overconsume, use small red plates for all the snacking that's going to be done. Because again, with the small size, people are going to be thinking that they're, potentially eating more when they've heaped it up. And then red actually draws our attention to what we're consuming in a way that makes us pay sort of extra vigilance to it, and has been shown to make us eat less than if food is served on, let's say, a white plate or a blue plate.
Small red plates. That's fascinating. Neuroscientist Rachel Herz, she's author of Why You Eat What You Eat. Clearly, it's not just about tasting good. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Heather. It was great to be on.
Up next, how extreme warming in the Arctic could cause extreme cold in the Midwest. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A pocket of Arctic air rolled down over Canada and the Midwest this past week and brought record cold temperatures, as low as the minus 50s. Makes me cold just to say it. Schools were closed, mail delivery was suspended, and several deaths were linked to the cold. President Trump quipped on Twitter that he wanted global warming to, quote, come back fast, suggesting, as he has many times before, that the cold weather proves climate change isn't happening. But that's far from the truth. In fact, this extreme cold may be directly linked to extreme warming in the Arctic. Jennifer Francis was one of the first scientists to connect the dots between Arctic warming and winter weather here in the mid-latitudes. She's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Research Center. Jennifer, always good to talk with you. I understand you're enjoying the boating life in Florida right now.
Yes, we're very fortunate to be not experiencing this attack of the polar vortex in person.
Well, I think, it's worth noting while those of us, at least in the upper half of the United States, are obsessing about the cold temperatures that have hit, Australia is in the midst of a record-setting heat wave. And in fact, the Berkeley Earth Research Group released their analysis that 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record. The three above it were 2016, 2015, and 2017. I mean, the last 4 years have been the four warmest years on record. It seems pretty clear that climate change is happening.
Exactly. If you look at a global map right now of temperature differences from normal, you'll see that there are many more places that are warmer than normal than the ones that are colder than normal. The only two real areas that are cold are the center of North America and the northern part of Central Eurasia. So anybody who says that this cold is somehow disproving global warming just hasn't bothered to look at what is going on elsewhere.
And yet every time we see an outbreak of extreme cold, we do hear that argument from someone that this disproves climate change. So how do you reconcile extreme cold, in some cases record-setting cold, in certain locales with this global warming trend?
Well, the first thing is to make the distinction between climate and weather. And climate is the average weather conditions at any given place in a particular season. And so weather is really the day-to-day variations in the conditions that you'd experience at any one place. Sometimes people liken this to somebody's personality being like climate, but your mood can vary from day to day, and that would be kind of like what weather is. But what we're experiencing right now over the Midwest truly is an extreme case of just, you know, generational record breaking. In some places, they truly have never seen cold quite like this. So there is some additional explanation that needs to happen. And this does, we believe, have a connection to global warming, believe it or not.
Well, Jennifer Francis, before we get into, you know, more of your research connecting the warming in the Arctic to how the polar vortex behaves, I mean, most of us here in the United States associate that phrase with these cold outbreaks during the winter, but that's not actually what the polar vortex is, in essence. Can we just step back and describe what is the polar vortex?
Sure, and I was just about to do that. So the polar vortex is often gets used incorrectly. So the true polar vortex is sitting over the North Pole, way up high in the atmosphere, in a layer called the stratosphere. It's about 30 miles up. And it's a very strong belt of winds encircling the northern hemisphere. And inside that circle of wind is very cold air. The true polar vortex is only there in the wintertime. And the true polar vortex in the stratosphere tends to be very circular most of the time.
Thus the name vortex.
Yes, exactly, yes. Occasionally, something will cause it to become less circular. It can take on the shape of a dumbbell or even split into two or even three separate circulations. And when that happens, those separate smaller circulations can drift southward, allowing warm air to instead invade the Arctic. And so we get this reversal. And that's exactly what's happening now. We have one of these smaller circulations of polar vortex air that has drifted down over North America, and it has reinforced the cold air at the surface with this upper level, very cold air directly from the Arctic.
I mean, if you look at recent temperature maps, it's pretty striking. I've seen a number of them where you're kind of looking down at the North Pole, and it's kind of reddish and pinkish, right? Warm temperatures at the North Pole, which first of all is not what we would expect. Mm-hmm. And then you see, you know, the frigid blues, and actually like three, just like you were describing, three circles of this cold air down over the United States and then over kind of parts of Asia on the other side of the world. Mm-hmm. But just a bizarre kind of backwardness to that, to see the North Pole actually be warmer than parts of Canada or Russia.
Exactly. And all that cold air from the Arctic is not up there where it belongs. It's invading North America and also the northern part of Eurasia.
So you mentioned that these events where the polar vortex can kind of split and start to drift, that they happen. But what causes them to happen, and what role does global warming play in making those happen, perhaps?
So they do happen naturally, for sure, just through random fluctuations in the atmosphere. The chaos of atmospheric winds and dynamics can make these things happen totally naturally. But we are seeing an increase in the frequency of these splitting up of the true polar vortex this way. It happened last year as well. Normally, we'd only expect to see them every few years. And it goes back to the very warm Arctic conditions in this area north of Western Russia, and the fact that it tends to fortify this ridge that occurs in that area. And when that ridge gets really strong, because of that extra heat that's come out of the ocean, it can generate extra wave energy in the jet stream. In the wintertime, that wave energy can transfer upwards into the stratosphere. And if enough of it gets transferred and it goes on for a long enough time, it can actually have this effect on the polar vortex to either make it misshapen, distort it, or even cause it to have one of these splits. And as I said, this is pretty new research, but the last couple of years, it seems that this is exactly what's happened. We've been able to watch this heat and this waviness in the jet stream move upward into the upper atmosphere, and the resulting splitting of the polar vortex.
I'm curious, Jennifer, we only hear about the polar vortex as it's setting, or these, as these, you know, dips in the polar vortex are about to happen, as we're about to get hit by the cold air, basically. How do these events end? Does the polar vortex somehow reassemble, or once that one vortex at the North Pole has fallen apart into these multiple different pieces, is that pretty much it for this winter?
Right. So it's a really good question as to how they end. So it's still really dark up there in the Arctic, and it's still cooling off because there's really no source of heat other than what it gets occasionally from winds coming from the south. And so the polar vortex basically reestablishes itself eventually because it's continually trying to get colder up there. And these spinning vortices that are dripping down across North America and Eurasia kind of run out of gas, if you will, and they eventually get reabsorbed into the larger scale wind circulation of the atmosphere.
eventually, though, doesn't sound like, we're out of the woods quite yet.
No, not at all. In fact, one of the interesting attributes of these of this kind of situation is that it does tend to create a very persistent pattern. So even though you're going to warm up after this blast of cold air for a couple of days, there's another blast coming. And it's because this spinning upper level circulation in the stratosphere is still up there. And so it wants to bring these continuing blasts of Arctic air down into the center of the country. So, yeah, you're not out of the woods yet.
Jennifer Francis is a senior scientist at Woods Hole Research Center, but we reached her at the marina where she's spending some time this winter in Florida. Jennifer, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. In the final hours of 2018, the Massachusetts legislature passed a law banning the use of 11 flame retardants in furniture, mattresses, carpeting, electronic equipment, and more. Firefighters and children's health advocates strongly backed the measure, but Governor Charlie Baker decided not to sign it. So now legislators have refiled the bill. Proponents of the ban say the flame retardants in question are toxic and that they don't actually provide the intended fire protection. So what's the evidence? Kate Hoffman is a research assistant professor at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment, and she's a winner of the 2018 Joan M. Daisy Outstanding Young Scientist Award for her work looking at our exposure to toxic chemicals. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This bill, this Massachusetts bill, specifically bans not actually the use, but the sale of products that do use 11 different flame retardants. If you look at the names of them, it's kind of an alphabet soup. What are some of these chemicals? Is it all one class of chemicals, or is this just a whole host of different things?
Mm-hmm. So this Massachusetts legislation actually applies to several different classes of flame retardants that are largely part of a class known as the organophosphate flame retardants and also come from a class of brominated flame retardants. And many of these brominated flame retardants have already been pulled from the market in the United States and banned in a number of other countries due to concerns that they're really persistent in the environment and in the human body, meaning that once they make it inside your body, they stay there for a long time and can potentially impact your health. And then the organophosphate flame retardants, they're also persistent in the environment, but they're metabolized by your body more quickly. And that's why some people originally thought that these might be a good alternative to use instead of the brominated flame retardants. But we're starting to see now that even though they're metabolized quickly, they could be impacting our health.
If the brominated flame retardants are already banned in the U.S., then why would this bill be necessary? Why do we need a new ban on them?
So at this time, these particular flame retardants aren't banned in the United States. They've been pulled from the market and they're not used in products to the same extent that they were in the past. So I think this is sort of a means of covering the bases.
And what do we know about the effects that these types of chemicals have on the human body?
At this point, there's pretty strong evidence that the use of flame retardants in household products could be potentially impacting human health. The weight of that evidence certainly varies depending on which of these flame retardant chemicals that you're talking about. But many of the compounds have been linked to negative health outcomes, including things like reduced fertility, impacts on children's health and their IQs, and for some, increases in the risk of cancer.
Hmm. And these are, as we already noted, used in a whole range of products. But it's pretty shocking to think, I mean, when we think of something as an additive, we think it's a small amount of something. But in some cases, these flame retardants can be a significant proportion of the actual material that's being made or sold, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, people often picture this as a very small additive in the product, but these flame retardants are, particularly in things like furniture, sort of sprayed on the foam used in furniture after the foam is manufactured. And in some cases, they can be found at the level of sort of pounds in a typical American couch.
Wow. Well, Kate Hoffman, your work is looking at the exposure that we have to these potentially harmful chemicals. I mean, when these chemicals are sprayed onto the foam or used to make a foam pad for a mattress, a couch, or whatever, how do we actually end up exposed to those chemicals? I mean, we're not eating our couches, presumably.
Right, exactly. So basically, these different flame retardants aren't chemically bound to any of the products that they're added to. So over time, they sort of off-gas, particularly when the product's used more and it sort of heats up. So you can think about like sitting on your couch or electronics warming up. That's going to increase the rate of flame retardants coming out of that particular product potentially. And then also just over time, you know, we sit on our couches and that causes friction over them and little particles break off into the air and dust in our houses.
So what kinds of levels of exposure are we actually talking about? I mean, we have the ability to detect really, really, really tiny amounts of just about everything at this point, it seems. I mean, are we talking about in the human body large quantities of these chemicals showing up?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to say because we don't know exactly what a specific level of exposure, how that corresponds to a specific health outcome. What we do know at this point is that we can find these chemicals in certainly greater than 95% of people living in the United States, and the levels are extremely variable. So some people do have pretty low levels of the chemical, but some people have much higher levels in their bodies.
One of the groups that was strongly backing the bill that did not make it past Governor Baker this past year was firefighters. I mean, we know that firefighters are at higher risk for some types of cancers, but smoke, I mean, even if it's just good old-fashioned plain wood smoke, is not good for you. Is there any way to link some of these health risks in firefighters specifically to these flame retardant chemicals?
I think it's going to be hard. I mean, we've shown that there are, you know, that firefighters have higher levels of exposure to a lot of these chemicals simply because, you know, you're taking the material and you're combusting it, so you're getting a lot more off-gassing there than you would be, you know, just as a normal resident in your home. But there are certainly other exposures that you're getting as a firefighter, you know, other products burning in the home that firefighters could be exposed to as well.
I mean, if we look at the flip side of the equation, right, it sounds like we've got some evidence, not necessarily a really strong case about the health risks of these chemicals, but they're there presumably to save lives during fires. Do we have evidence that they do that?
The research that we're doing here at Duke's shows that the flame retardants used in polyurethane foam that's used to make baby products and furniture is a big source of exposure in the home environment, and that's sort of an exposure that most people in the population are experiencing. And at least in those applications, research suggests that flame retardants are not effective enough to stop something from burning and that they don't really provide any meaningful reduction in fire hazard.
Shy of this statewide ban, for those who are concerned about the potential impacts of flame retardants, are there alternatives or ways that consumers right now can try to avoid these chemicals?
Sure. Reducing exposure is hard because these chemicals are used in so many different products and they're sort of ubiquitous and everywhere in the environment at this point. But there are some things that we think that might be helpful in reducing exposure. So there's some research to suggest that improved hygiene, so things like washing your hands more frequently or washing your hands before you eat and vacuuming the dust out of your home more frequently, could potentially be ways to reduce your exposure. And for folks that are really concerned about their levels of exposure, there are flame retardant-free versions of a lot of products available, and you kind of see that in marketing now that a lot of companies are expanding into this greener and flame retardant-free customer base. And for those people, they might consider looking for flame retardant-free options when they bring a new product into their homes.
Kate Hoffman is a research assistant professor at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, a new book explores how alternative medicine does and doesn't work. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Acupuncture, herbal remedies, homeopathy, energy medicine, these practices are widely dismissed by the mainstream medical establishment as lacking any scientific backing. And yet, we all know someone with a story of a dramatic recovery attributed to such alternative practices. My next guest set out to bridge that disconnect. Melanie Warner's new book is The Magic Feather Effect: The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. Melanie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is pretty clear in the early pages of the book that you're coming into this as a skeptic. You recount one scene, you're at a weekend conference and everybody's being woken up on Saturday morning by an energy dance and you opt for the energy in your coffee cup instead, going the more, we might say, conventional route. Did you come into this wanting to validate alternative medicine or wanting to debunk it?
I came in with a little bit of both, but also neither. I didn't want to be a skeptic in the sense that I wanted to point out what was wrong with alternative medicine. And I wanted to look for people that were effective practitioners and really believed in what they were doing. But at the same time, I was also skeptical about how people talked about the ways in which their practices would work. So for energy healing, for instance, that there's this idea of life force energy moving through your body. I was skeptical about that. And for acupuncture, acupuncturists talk about qi, which is a similar idea, moving along meridian lines in the body. I didn't want to dismiss those out of hand and say, absolutely, this doesn't exist. So I was open and I went on a journey to try and understand whether there was any science behind some of those ideas. But I didn't find evidence for that.
And when you take something like acupuncture, which has been very well studied, over 1,000 studies, what does that science say? And is there any chance that the way that science is being done, potentially, probably by scientists who are extremely skeptical about the value of that treatment, that they're kind of missing something and maybe missing the actual effectiveness of the treatment?
Yeah, it's not a simple story when you look at the research. So usually these studies will be set up where a group of patients gets actual acupuncture, where the needles go into the body, the thin needles go in at really specific points along the body. And then another group of patients get a sham or a fake kind of acupuncture, where often they're using retractable needles that don't actually go into the skin, and sometimes they're put in the wrong places. And what you find with these studies is that there's not a big difference between the people who get the real acupuncture and the fake acupuncture. But a lot of studies that have been done in recent years have a third group, a group of patients that is just getting the usual care that they get from their doctor. So usually medication, doctor's visit, sometimes exercise. And when you look at that group compared to both types of acupuncture, the real and the fake, you see these interesting effects where people are getting relief. People are feeling like their pain is reduced. They have more mobility. They feel better. Their quality of life. All of these things are improved relative to what people are normally getting. So there's two ways to look at that. The skeptics say, oh, that's not valuable. I came away, and a lot of other scientific researchers come away, with the view that, look, if these things are working better than the available treatments that we have, and they might be working for reasons that we don't fully understand, and that certainly are not the way acupuncturists say it works. And it that encompasses things like placebo effects, the interaction between the acupuncturist and the person getting the treatment, and all these kind of what scientists sometimes call non-specific effects of medicine. And there's a thinking among researchers that these aspects are actually very important in treatments.
Melanie Warner, one of the things that you kind of conclude is that there are a lot of reasons that might explain individual people's accounts of healing and recovery. But of course, in the title of your book, you say that's the power of belief. What I took away from the book and what you seem to be saying just now is that it's not just about the belief of the person who's receiving the treatment. It's almost more about perhaps the attention and the empathy being given to them by the practitioner, that maybe that's actually the most powerful part of some of these treatments.
Yeah, it's not just the conscious belief when we think of, oh, I think this treatment is going to help me. It's the whole experience that you have in what scientists call the therapeutic encounter. And this can be powerful in a medical setting too, but there's a strong argument to be made that some of these elements are much more prevalent in alternative medicine. So like you mentioned, empathy. Sometimes alternative practitioners, they'll sit down and they'll talk with patients about things happening in their life, not just like, well, how's your back? But it can be, not always, but it can be a much more supportive and holistic approach. The complaint sometimes is that doctors treat the disease and not the patient. And not that doctors can't, and there are some very, very good doctors out there, but the system isn't really set up to help them do that. You know, appointments are very short. They're seeing many, many patients during the day. In some ways, it's not as fair for them because they have a lot more on their plate in terms of conditions that they have to treat and tests they have to run, and they have to make sure they're not missing anything very, very serious. Whereas our alternative practitioners are seeing kind of a more finite set of conditions. But yeah, those elements of attention and support, and also this feeling of safety, right? Those things have been you know, largely dismissed in the past by science, and now they're starting to be taken seriously as real elements of medicine.
I guess I would maybe separate those from what you would call a placebo, because as you're saying, those are things that we can measure and say these are things that are having an effect. The placebo effect of, you know, taking an empty pill seems to be a little bit different. How much do we understand about how that works and how powerful it can be?
Yeah, there are different types of placebos and then different types of placebo effects. So the example of a sugar pill, which is a classic example, is a more simple placebo. It mostly involves the expectation of relief, like I take this pill, I'm going to feel better because my doctor has told me or I believe it. And then there's also the ritual of taking a pill. People think that that is important too. Just the practice of getting it out of the container, putting it in your mouth, getting a glass of water, that ritual has a kind of conditioning effect as well. But then other types of placebos can be a lot more complex and rich, like some of the things that we've just been talking about. And some of those can happen in an alternative setting and also in a conventional setting. Like one of the most effective placebos is surgery. You see, when studies have been done where people get these fake surgeries, like just an incision on their knee or in their back, as opposed to the real full surgery, there are these really robust effects where people feel better and it lasts for sometimes years for people.
Wow.
And you have a lot going on with surgery. You have incredibly complex rituals. You have the belief that this is a highly trained person that is going in and fixing your body. A lot of people feel safe. You know, they feel like, okay, I'm finally going to get this fixed now. So all those things are what we now know go into producing really interesting placebo effects.
I think when we say the phrase placebo effect, we kind of associate it with dismissing what's happening, the results of that, that it's just, it's kind of a figment of our imaginations. But you, as you're digging into this research, highlight the fact that, in fact, there are some people who respond more strongly to placebo effects, as you were just saying, the different kinds of placebos that you could use and the different types of ailments that they might treat. And in a lot of cases, the placebo effect can have real physiological effects, right?
Yeah, scientists, I think, have just scratched the surface in understanding how placebo effects work. They're really, it all leads back to the brain, which one neuroscientist calls it the most complex known thing in the universe, which is really saying something when you consider black holes and all the other elements of space that we don't understand at all. So you have 80 billion neurons with the possibility of 100 trillion connections between them. So the complexity is immense. And so scientists have started trying to understand a little bit about what happens in the brain when you experience a placebo effect, because that's where it all starts. Sometimes there's a possibility that it can go beyond the brain and into the body with certain types of placebo effects. But for the most part, you're really changing wiring in the brain. You're releasing neurotransmitters. One of the most well-known mechanisms is for pain. And the thinking is there's probably different placebo effects for pain, but the one that scientists understand the most about is the release of endorphins in your brain. They're very similar to opiates, and these attach to receptor cells that actually block signals or tone down signals that are coming up from your body. And so your brain does not produce pain.
You say in the book, and I think it was someone you spoke to said to you, there's not a one-to-one relationship between physical bodily damage and the experience of pain. But in reading this book, I found myself kind of caught in this circular logical loop of, you know, the pain we feel may not be correlated to physical damage. At the same time, our brain might be able to fix pain, but it's not going to fix physical damage. I mean, we're kind of caught in this weird loop of what is actually real, what is damage or illness or disease, and whether or not it needs to be fixed.
Exactly. I mean, pain is a fascinating phenomenon. It's a harm alarm. It prevents us from injuring ourselves. People that are born with a congenital condition where they can't feel pain don't have a very long life expectancy. You know, it's an incredibly valuable survival tool. But at the same time, the system can go awry, and it can lead us to believe that our body is in greater hurt or greater danger than it is. One of the fascinating stories was a man who was the first person to study placebo effects. He was at Harvard in the 30s and 40s, and he was sent over. He's an anesthesiologist. He was sent over to World War II in Italy in these battlefield hospitals, and he saw patients coming in with these horrific wounds coming off the battlefield, and he was stunned by the fact that very few of them said they were in great pain, and very few of them asked for or wanted morphine. And he thought, well, something's got to be going on with this. And he wondered if they were all in shock, and he determined that most of them weren't. And he later did a study. He compiled some data from the war zone, and then he compared it to civilians back in Boston at hospitals when they had come in from some kind of trauma, usually car accidents. He found that about 30% of the battlefield soldiers asked for pain medications, and 80% of the civilians did. And this was incredibly revealing to him, because it showed that pain wasn't what he thought it was and what everyone thought it was. So there's a lot of modulation that our beliefs are the stories we tell. And this man at Harvard, Henry Beecher was his name, his theory was that the meaning that a hospital had was very different for the soldiers versus the civilians. The soldiers felt that they were safe, that they were off the battlefield, they were attended by doctors and nurses, and they were probably going to go home soon. The civilians, on the other hand, had just gotten in some horrible accident and were heading into a world of uncertainty where they were going to have to deal with eventually going back to their normal daily life with some major injury. So he determined that those beliefs and those stories, those narratives, those expectations could have a profound effect on whether or not the brain produces pain and how much.
Melanie Warner, your new book, The Magic Feather Effect, is kind of predicated on the idea that there are these two different categories of scientifically based medical treatments, conventional medicine, and non-scientific alternative medicine. And at the end of the book, you actually kind of call for conventional doctors and alternative healers to each learn from each other and maybe be a little bit more like each other. What would that look like in your mind?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's keeping alternative therapies, especially ones that have been well studied like acupuncture, keeping them alternative, in quotes, is the fact that they have not embraced a more scientific theory to how their practices work. So still talking about qi and meridians. And it's not that, I'm not trying to argue that, oh, we should stop talking about this. I mean, these are steeped in hundreds of years or thousands of years of history. But one acupuncturist I talked to, who happens to also be a researcher at Harvard, he had an interesting way of thinking about it. He, you know, as a scientist, he's not trying to look for the existence of qi and meridians. He thinks of these things as kind of as metaphors for how to treat patients and for just a kind of a different holistic, poetic, almost understanding of the body. But I think in order for alternative medicine to move forward, I think they need to have a little bit more of an open embrace of, let's think about what are the active ingredients in our practices. Let's consider placebo effects. Let's consider other mind-body interactions. Let's consider the kind of non-specific aspect of touch and the healing effects that can have, and not focus so much on life force energy moving in the body. On the other side, conventional medicine and doctors can benefit by understanding the way that alternative practitioners are healers, for lack of a better word. All the stuff we were talking about earlier about really sitting down and listening to patients and understanding what's going on and using their powers of intuition to figure out what people really need and how they need to be treated and understood.
Melanie Warner's new book is The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. Melanie, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.